Mr. Trouble never hangs around when he hears this mighty sound.
Here I come to save the day.
That means that mighty sea is on the way. Yes, sir, when there is a wrong to right, mighty sea will join the fight. On the sea or on the land, he gets the situation well in hand.
So though we are in danger, we never despair, 'cause we know that where there's danger, he is there.
He is there, on the land, on the sea, in the air.
Alrighty, folks, this is another episode of the Mighty Seek podcast. I know it's been a while. I had promised to get them out every 2 weeks. It's been about 4 or 5 now. Well, actually, let me take a look here. It's the 10th of January, and today is, what, the 10th of February? Yeah, it's been a month. It's not so bad. My last one was quite long and fairly well prepared, since I had done it for a conference, a presentation at a conference. So, you know, it has a slideshow and all that. So, to some extent, I felt like I had given you guys a good show and I could deserve a break. On top of that, I guess we'll do a little pre-ramble here. I've been working on a plugin for WordPress. I had switched over to WordPress for my kirkendall.org site, and really liked it. It's a pretty nice product. It's a nice open source project. They've done a really good job. I haven't fully dug into their security yet. I looked at the loaders, the loading files, and it is doing something to clean up inputs, so it's not completely overlooked. There is some attention to it, so I just haven't really dug into all of the details. But overall, it seems pretty good. So I was using it and noticed that its support for podcasting was flaky. Basically, for me anyway, I would put my link to my MP3 file in there and it wouldn't work. Once I put it in there once, it would create the enclosure tag, and then if I ever went back to the post and tried to edit it, it was often losing the link, and it was just kind of inconsistent. It was annoying me quite a bit. So I decided to write a plugin for WordPress, which I dubbed PodPress, you know, WordPress, podcasting, PodPress. And this thing is pretty neat. It's gotten a fair amount of response. To some degree, I'd put it out there to promote this show. And it does make podcasting with WordPress much cleaner. I've got a number of features I'm working on. One of them is WordPress already has support for uploading files. I may beef that up with a little CGI script that can actually handle larger files. This is what Loudblog had done, because PHP file upload limits are usually set in the PHP INI file, and it's some of the podcast files are going to be a little larger. So he had put together a separate, I think it was a Perl script or something like that. I may use the same thing. And that should improve things a bit. Once I get that in place, then what I'll do is, you'll be able to point to an MP3 file. Right now you can point to an MP3 file and it'll dynamically look at that file, grab its ID3 headers, and just let you see the information. And that was just kind of the initial iteration. This next one will actually, if you want, will pull the content from the ID3 tags and populate the fields in your post. So as you're posting, you can just specify the MP3 file and it'll auto-populate the rest of the post. And then if you update the post information, you change the title and content, you can write that back to the ID3 tag. So it should really cover most everything. I still have to work out how to do images, the cover art. once I get that figured out, then I'll be pretty happy with it. What else is going in there? There's a pop-up ability to do a pop-up player. Man, there's a ton of stuff I want to do with it. So if you've got any feature requests or any interest in PodPress, definitely visit the MightySeek.com website. There's a PodPress page, and there's been a lot of comments, but add your comments. I do read every single one of them. I don't always respond. I try to. But I definitely read them all, and I have a note file here of all the features, and maybe I'll actually create a page of feature requests at some point. Let's see. I also wanted to definitely give a shout out to Bob Cratchit. I hope I'm saying the last name right, but he was the first one and really the only one of the people that posted on iTunes, a comment on iTunes. It was kind of nice just to even know that I have a listener out there. Sometimes I'm not really sure. I did check my download stats yesterday for the first time and found that I had about 1,200 downloads. I'm not sure how many of them were re-downloads or, maybe the Flash player and somebody just, you know, heard a couple seconds of the intro or something, but a big show. It had about 1,000 to 1,200, and that was kind of impressive. I had no idea. I figured it was more like 30. So there's apparently more of you out there than I had expected. All right, so I know you're here for web application security. I've already rambled on for 5 or 6 minutes. And so let's get to the topic. The topic today is going to be about cross-site scripting. And cross-site scripting is a bit different than a lot of the other attacks that I generally will talk about. Usually, I'm talking about protecting the server from attacks. So preventing SQL injection attacks or various data type attacks against the server scripts and things that could damage data, and you know, even some of them with command injection can create backdoors, which I haven't gone into that yet, but I will be. Command injection is definitely a topic to discuss. The cross-site scripting is a bit different. Cross-site scripting is an instance where you are allowing your users to be attacked. So that's what I'm going to be talking about today. That's what I'm going to be going into. Before I do that, I just want to do a little play this plug for the LA Podcasters. And as soon as that's through, that's about a minute here. As soon as I play that, then I'll jump into cross-site scripting. And here we go.
Hello, this is Lance Anderson. And I'd like you to join me and some of my mates at the Rose Theater in West Lancashire on the 24th of February 2006 for my show, The Lance Anderson Podcast Experiment, featuring me, Dan Klass from The Bitterest Pill, Mark from the Tartan Podcast, and John and Rob from Top of the Pods. For more information and tickets, log on to highblue.co.uk/events or call 01-695-579-062. See you at the show.
All right, there we go. That's the LA Podcasters. Collection of really good guys over there. Dan Klass of The Bitterest Pill is actually one of the reasons that I decided to podcast. Not because he made it look so easy exactly, but because, well, yeah, I guess he made it look easy. Made it look a little easier than it actually is. But anyway, he does a great show. It was very entertaining. It was definitely the first show that I was really hooked on. Had to go back and listen to all the episodes. Great show. All right. What is cross-site scripting? Cross-site scripting has the acronym of CSS, which is also the same as cascading style sheets, which is a way of formatting a web page. So there's a ton of confusion around that acronym for a while, so eventually everybody settled on calling cross-site scripting XSS. So if you ever see it as XSS, they're talking about cross-site scripting as opposed to cascading style sheets. So, okay, what is cross-site scripting? Cross-site scripting is a way for an attacker to insert malicious script, okay, malicious client-side script, into a web page. So since these days the web applications are very dynamic, the content is also not always provided by the publisher, and the blogging world is extremely familiar with this, as well as, you know, bulletin boards and whatever. What I'm talking about here is that users are providing content in the way of comments, you know, posts on a bulletin board, whatever. Anytime a user is submitting content, if this content is not validated, then they could be inserting malicious script into the page. So let's go over a blog. In a blog, I put a post on there, and I, you know, on my podcast site, let's say. So I put the post on there. Okay, here's the show. And then there's a little link to send a comment. So you click on the comment, and you insert some script tags. So if you know anything about writing HTML and JavaScript, anytime you want to do JavaScript, what you would do is put script tags, and then within the script tags, you can put whatever JavaScript code you want. And that would get executed right away. Now, if I can't do a script tag, and so, let me stick to that. They put in the script tag, then they write in whatever JavaScript they want. And then they close their tags and they submit it. So now, you're another user, you come to my site, you want to see what the comments say about my podcast, and you click on the little comments link and you get a list of all the comments, and all of a sudden, some JavaScript executed on your computer. Now some would say, okay, big deal, right? It didn't do anything to the server, it just executed a little bit of client-side code. Well, that can be really dangerous to the user. It's not usually dangerous to the website. Maybe I'll back up. It actually could be, but in a roundabout way. What happens is if you're on a site that actually is providing cookies, so you have a session, you've had to log in somehow. If you have some credentials on this site, then the JavaScript can actually get that information and send it to somebody else. So, if I'm a bad guy and I put some script tags on a site, and I'm going to write in some JavaScript, then what I'm going to do is, in JavaScript, you can read cookies. You can actually get the cookies array. So, I would get the cookies array, find out what the name and value pairs are, and then I would generate a request. I would actually redirect your web page to my server, to a script on my server just waiting for name and value pairs to be sent to it. And then it would actually, that page would record these name and value pairs along with what site you were on and your IP address and your user agent and all that kind of stuff. Because now, if that's the case, and I'm actually sending your cookies, your session information, over to my server, then I could, you know, and I'm watching that. So I'll be sitting there waiting for some data to come in. As soon as some data comes in, I'll go to the site, or I'll actually configure my browser to have those same cookie name and value pairs. Then I'll go to the site, and it thinks I'm you. I've got your session. Now, you know, if you're on my blog site, and you're just some anonymous user, that means nothing. It's pointless for the attacker. However, let's say you're on Amazon, and somebody's been able to do this into a comment about a book, right? So you're on Amazon, you're browsing around looking at books, and on Amazon, people are able to submit comments, right? And ratings and recommendations and all kinds of stuff on Amazon. There's so much user-provided content on there. Now, Amazon's done a good job. That's why I'm picking on them. But they've done an extremely good job dealing with this issue. Let's say they hadn't been. So I'm on Amazon. Of course, we all know Amazon has one-click shopping or one-click checkout. So I'm on Amazon. I'm looking through these reviews. And I hit one of these reviews that has this nasty JavaScript in it that's actually going to take my session information, my cookie, name value pairs, and send it over to bad guy server. Now, bad guy server's waiting around. As soon as he sees that, he hits Amazon's site with those credentials. Now, Amazon thinks he's me. He's got my credentials. He's logged in as me. Now, I've got an account on Amazon, so if you know they've got my credit card information, he can start buying stuff and send it gift wrapped to another address. And boom, he has it sent to some P.O. box that only exists for a couple days, and then he walks away from that. So he could get a whole bunch of merchandise. He can go on eBay, same thing, on eBay. A bad seller could put up an item that, and he puts in some JavaScript in his item post on eBay, you know, he's added an auction. So on his auction description, it's got some of this nasty JavaScript. Boom, same thing. So he could put, you know, create an auction for some really popular thing that everybody's searching for and make it look fairly believable. You know, copy somebody else's auction. Make it fairly believable. But put in some nasty JavaScript in the comment. Now, again, eBay's done a very good job of protecting themselves. But had they not, then, you know, a bad guy could very quickly get my session information and hijack my session on eBay and start buying stuff. So this is a very serious matter. Now, you know, bring this into your bank account. So, you know, on the bank website or, you know, and they've got a little support forum or something like that. Anywhere that users are able to provide content that other users are able to see, cross-site scripting is a problem. So now that I've scared you enough about the problem as a user and as a content provider, I hope, if you haven't already been taking care of this and being concerned with cross-site scripting, I hope you start seeing a little glimmer of what the problem is. So there's been plenty of examples. PHP Nuke, which was a very popular content manager for a long time, and still is, really. I mean, there's been enough spin-offs that it's kind of diminished a little bit, but it had a ton of cross-site scripting problems. And those were actually, usually, you know, the administrator of a site tends to visit the site quite a bit and review all the comments and all that kind of stuff. So a number of the cross-site scripting attacks were actually driven around that. Or based around trying to get the admin account to the site. And they were very successful. A lot of PHP Nuke sites got hijacked because, you know, somebody put in a bad post in there and the admin would go look at it. Boom, the session information sent over to the bad guy's server and he logs in. Now, these cookie attacks are not the only thing you can do with cross-site scripting. It's just often the most useful. They could also do straight, you know, phishing attacks where they'll have a mock site set up that looks like the site that, so let's say it's a shopping cart thing and it's not one that you already have an account with, like on Amazon. I can actually set up a mock site that looks exactly the same, and the domain would be very, very, very similar. Maybe I would transpose a couple letters or something. So I'd create a domain that's, you know, some, let's say you're on somesite.com, well, I'll make SOEMsite.com. So that, you know, user's not necessarily going to notice that right away. So I'll create the site, and I'll basically mirror somesite.com's content. But at the point of checkout, you know, I'm the one collecting the information. So if I'm able to insert some script there, I'll redirect the user to my site, and they'll think they're looking at the same content. But in fact, they'll be on my site, you know, my hack site, and they'll never know the difference. And that was because I was able to insert JavaScript that did a redirect. So that's another method. There's a ton. It's really as creative as the hacker can be about it. Because with JavaScript, you can do a lot. You can, you know, insert a hidden iframe. JavaScript is extremely powerful. If you have any questions about its power or capabilities, look at Google Maps and Gmail. Those are really good examples of Ajax-style websites that really show off some of the power of JavaScript and how it can manipulate the content of a site. So, now Ajax does have a limitation of only working within the domain that the page is on, but the concepts all stand in that if an attacker can insert JavaScript, they can manipulate a lot of the content and really manipulate the user's experience on the site and what happens. So cross-site scripting is not just about cookies, but that's a primary example of the problem. Okay, so what are the things that, if you're a content provider, what are the things you're going to be looking for? There's a number of things. The primary things that you're going to want to do is block script tags. Okay, so if you take the greater than less than signs that go around script, the text script, so that's the tags, and you convert those to ampersand, LT, semicolon to, you know, for the less than. And then greater than is ampersand GT semicolon. So you're converting it over to its URL encoded version, I guess, whatever. Anyway, you convert it over, then that'll protect you considerably. Now, there's still other attacks, so you would also want to only have to put script tags. But that's the only way you can actually have something just launch automatically. The other thing you can do is you can actually put a link in your post. And if a user clicked on it, if you've ever done HTML and JavaScript, what you can do is you can actually do a link. So an A href, you know, less than A, and then space href equals. And normally you would put a link in there and then, you know, give it a link name. So you're going to ahref the URL that you're going to, close the bracket, put in, you know, some text string that would be the link or an image or whatever it's going to be, and then you would close your a tags. Well, instead of putting ahref equals URL, you could put ahref equals JavaScript colon space and then a series of JavaScript code. For most of the really useful JavaScript stuff, you're going to have to put a parentheses around it. So one way to block it is to look for the string JavaScript colon. Now, that could be valid in the post, so that may be a little over aggressive, but it's one option. Or you can definitely look for the string ahref equals, or href equals JavaScript colon. And if you see that, you'd want to basically just take that whole string and remove it. The other thing you can do is you can take your ampersands and translate them. So, you know, your parentheses. You can take the parentheses, so it'd be ampersand pound 40 semicolon for the open paren, and for the closed paren would be ampersand pound 41 semicolon. So you can do that. The other thing you can do, you'll also want to block generally, is pounds and ampersands, so that they don't try to trick your code. Because there's a lot of ways of, if they, you know, if they do certain sequences of things, they can actually double encode, which would then result in an unencoded version, and you can kind of really goof around with the escaping. So you'd also want to escape ampersands and pounds. So you'd convert an ampersand to ampersand pound 35 and ampersand pound 38, or flip that around, whatever. So you can filter these, and I'll have a link to some more information and the details of all this. But anyway, you can convert everything around. And this way, when it gets out to the user, it's actually displayed as the exact text that the attacker put in place. So instead of actually having an href, it would actually print out the ampersand LT and the ampersand GTs, the brackets, as a bracket, because that's an HTML encoded version of it, and so the web page would just literally print it rather than use it as a tag. So I'm not sure if you're getting that, but the user will see the string rather than it be an active part of the web page. It would just be basically textified, if you want to. I don't know how else to describe that, but I'll have to put some examples, I guess, is the best way to do this. But if you're a content provider, the key thing is to escape the dangerous characters. So you'll want to go through that, escape all the characters, and then allow the post to go through. If you're a user and you want to protect yourself, there's a couple things that you need to do. As with, you know, emails that come in that have HTML, you don't want to click on links without verifying them. What I usually will do if I get an email, or if I'm on a link to a page, or I'm on a page that has a link I want to follow, I'm paranoid. So I tend to right-click, copy link, I copy the link text or the link URL, and then I actually have a text editor window always open. So I always paste into that, and then I look at the link and see, is that exactly what I wanted? Then I copy from the text editor back to my browser. Well, I'm a little paranoid, but it's protected me pretty well. But that just gives you an example of how careful you can be. The other thing you want to tend to do is use an alternate browser, like Firefox. Firefox has a ton of plugins. I actually have a couple of the extensions that I have, or not plugins, they're extensions. The extensions that I actually use to help protect me is there's a NoScript plugin, and basically what that does is any site that I go to, by default, JavaScript actually is disabled, and it gives me a very simple little button on the bottom that I can click on and enable JavaScript either for a given session or for that site permanently. And so as I start trusting a site, I'll allow JavaScript to function there. Now, if JavaScript is disabled, then these cross-site scripting attacks are not going to work against you, because they rely on the JavaScript. Well, they can also rely on VBScript, ActiveScript, ActiveX, and Flash. Those can all actually be used as well. We tend to think of JavaScript because that's the most ubiquitous standard scripting language that's available. I mean, everybody supports JavaScript, so that's the one that people tend to use. Now, if your VB script is on, and ActiveScript really only work on Internet Explorer. So if you're not using Internet Explorer and you've switched over to Firefox, you're protected. Those are just not going to work. Now, a website that needs those, which is few and far between, those sites wouldn't work. So you'd be in trouble, but you know, if you really needed those sites. But you could always use IE as necessary, is what actually I do. There are a few sites that Firefox doesn't work well with, or I don't feel like disabling some pop-up blocking or whatever so that that site will work. I'll actually use IE in those instances. All right, the other... Let's see. I'm actually also very paranoid about my cookies, and I actually use a extension called Permit Cookies. And what that does is a website is not actually allowed to set a cookie at all until I tell it that it's allowed to. So I have very few cookies, and that kind of protects me from some of the tracking cookies that can take place. But and there's also FlashBlock, which will disable Flash. And as I mentioned, Flash can be used as one of the options. I also mentioned ActiveX. Again, if you're using Firefox, that's not an issue. So, as a user, you can protect yourself quite a bit by using, you know, like I said, using Firefox, you know, really looking at a link. If you mouse over a link on the bottom of your browser, it'll actually tell you where the link's going to. You don't want to trust the text, because a link is in two parts. The link has what's in the ahref, and then they close the bracket, and then they put whatever text string they want. It could say click here, but it could also say http://, site we think you want, that we want you to think this is going to .com, and then they can end their a anchor, their a tags, and then the link looks like it's going to site we want you to think it's going to. But in the href, it's a whole different site, or it's some JavaScript code. So if you mouse over the link on the bottom of your browser, it'll actually display to you the actual link that it's going to. So it's a good idea to make sure they match. Now, as I mentioned, if I'm a clever bad guy, I'm going to set up a domain that looks very similar, maybe has two letters transposed. So most people will miss that. So if I mouse over and, you know, two letters have been flipped, or the domain, instead of an O, it's a zero, I may not notice that. And even though I've moused over and looking at the link, I may miss it. So as a user, protecting yourself is very difficult, because even a trusted site could become vulnerable if they mess up on something. And, you know, it's kind of those situations where who you're going to trust, or... I just try to limit my risk with tools like Firefox and NoScript. Those really limit my exposure quite a bit. So, let's see. Any other quick questions that I can run through and answer on that? Okay, encryption. Does encryption protect you from cross-site scripting? Encryption would be something like HTTPS or SSL, if you're familiar with more technical side of things. If you're on an HTTPS site, you'll have that little lock icon in your browser, and you'll feel very secure. Cross-site scripting is client-side code that's in the content of the web page. So if a user has gotten it in that web page, then encryption matters not. It protects you none at all. I think that's about it. I think that covers it for cross-site scripting. I hope this has been instructional and useful. Sorry for some of the rambling. I didn't spend a lot of time preparing for this, which I guess is often the case. It's a bit off the cuff. I know this stuff inside and out, and so maybe I miss things. I'll go back and listen to this and put together some show notes, because this is fairly complex and fairly tricky to understand. But I hope you've gotten some useful information. And that's it. This was Mighty Seek.
we're just listening for his call.
Here I come to save the day.
That means that Mighty Seed is on the way.